Hello, everybody. I'm Tom Dorsey.
And I'm Ben Jones.
And it's January 31st, 2018. Online with us is Tony Fadul. And this is going to be an interesting podcast. Tony was the head of sales for Federated Mutual Funds. And he's been in the business, I would say, at least 50 years. I mean, I've been in here 47. Tony was at Merrill Lynch when I came in as a stockbroker. He was sitting in front of me. The interesting thing about that, Tony worked his way through college. This was back in, Tony, late 60s, 70s?
Yeah, as a matter of my hire date with Merrill was August the 6th of 1966.
Yeah, okay. Now, this tells you something, because what we're doing today with this podcast is we're going back to the early 1960s, and we're going to talk about the markets back then, because what we did in the webcast is we talked about the markets of the 60s and why this looked like it. When we looked at our data and we looked at how overbought the stock market is, we had to go back to 1961 to find the last time that we were as overbought as we are now. In other words, skewed to the right-hand side of the bell curve was 1961. So I thought, you know, we need to talk about the 60s and what happened in the 60s. Commodities were a play back then and reasons why. And I think we may end up with a replay of what took place in the 1960s. There's only one person I can think of that would remember every piece of it, every day of it, and be able to bring it up was Tony Fadul. And he and I are great friends. My mentor in the business back when I was a stockbroker at Merrill Lynch, and that's when we were stockbrokers back then. We weren't advisors. We were stockbrokers. And Tony worked his way through college in the back office. So he understood all of the administrative back office type of things that took place. When I sat behind him at Merrill Lynch, that was a godsend because I learned the back office. I learned about being a stockbroker, all those types of things. Tony and I have been friends now. For 43 years, when I came to Merrill Lynch. And Tony, apparently, since you came in 1966, you've been in this business for 52 years.
That's correct.
Not many people you can say that are still standing at 52 years, and I'll tell you, you look like you're 37. So, Ben.
Tommy, thank you.
Ben Flattery Jones
will get
is
you
with
everywhere.
Us. I'm sorry, I jumped in on you there, but I want to say Ben Jones is with us. He's been here. He's been with Dorsey Wright since 2009, came as an intern, worked his way through college, came back as a full-time analyst, one of the more senior people here, and Ben is with me right now. So most of the podcast is going to be with Tony, and I want him to begin recounting what took place in the 1960s. So let's have fun, Tony. Hit it.
Well, I'm all for it, Tom. Thank you so much. Well, what an honor to be on a podcast with you. Just a delight. And your friendship has meant a lot to me over these many years, and it's just nice to have a simpatico person, been there, done that, and we've lived through so much. As our discussion yesterday, what we got into was the similarities and the dissimilarities to these markets. And I've always seen everything, as everyone would, through the lens of their own experience and as a young kid coming into the market, how my views changed, matured, the lessons I learned, some of them quite bitter lessons about Wall Street and about going with the crowd and things like that, and having a bit of a contrarian view over the years after suffering through some of the nonsense of Wall Street. It has given me an interesting view and a perspective. And as you and I talked, that's really what I wanted to share a little bit with your listeners today on the podcast. Number one, remember, I was a kid. I came to Merrill Lynch as a kid. I'm working in the back office. I'm fascinated by it with no real understanding of what's going on. I mean, don't get me wrong. I understood what stocks were, what bonds were. But what these brokers did, I didn't really understand that other than buy low, sell high, repeat often. Everything was transaction-driven, and their forte, their way of branding themselves, their experience and their expertise was in figuring out what to buy, what to sell, and what to do next for people. And that was really what I thought the business was all about. If you really just push back from it, you're basically trying to beat the market. Not on an annual basis. You're trying to beat it every single day for your clients to add some value to them. Managed money, as we know it, was really reserved for, you know, at the trust company level, our very large private wealth management accounts. at what we call, you and I would call, the retail level, just dealing with the public out there. We weren't really providing that. We were really providing ways of buying some bonds, buying some stocks, et cetera, putting a portfolio together, you and I doing that for them, and then managing it literally on a day-to-day, week-to-week, month-to-month basis.
But we Tony, I'm not sure we put portfolios together. You know, people would call us up and say, what's hot, what's not? And they already had their defined benefit plan. They just said, were Philip Morris. They just had to get there 30 years, stay alive 30 years, and you got it. So we were much more trading-oriented.
Much so. We spent a lot of our day, as you'll recall, trying to figure out, okay, what's the market going to do today, or maybe this week or the next couple of weeks, and are we positioned correctly? What can we help our clients with? What can we buy today? And then what do we need to be out of? What do we need to sell? And let me just give you the larger backdrop. The market, in terms of the indexes, what was happening with the Dow. And I say the Dow because there was much more of a focus on the Dow back in those days than the S&P index. We were very focused on those 30 industrials. The history was much longer. As you know, Tom, the Dow, it goes back over 100 years. If you take a look at the S&P index, it wasn't created until 1957. So it was a relatively new, broader market way of looking at things. So we looked at the Dow, and the Dow in the that mid to late 60s was still in the midst of a bull market overall. I mean, it wasn't as robust as what we've seen recently. And secondly, you didn't have as many people participating. There was an interesting factoid done by the New York Stock Exchange. The average household penetration of people who own stocks, this was in 1970, by the way, was roughly 28%. Wow. 28% of households exposed to stocks. So it was a limited number of people that had an interest in the market, as you said, that actually wanted to individually buy stocks or sell stocks and take on additional risk or have the capital and wherewithal to put into it. Very different than today. Everybody's tuned into it. The second thing that is so different today that I marvel at is how tuned in people are to the markets, whereas back then, there was no source of information. There was no internet. There was no CNBC. There was no Bloomberg news feeds all day long. Basically, you had to call a broker, such as you and I, to get the information, even to find out what the market was doing that day. We were in control a bit of that kind of information. So it's a different environment today, but what hasn't changed is human beings. You and I, the people we dealt with today, people are involved. And human emotion still plays a factor. So if there's anything I became a student of over the decades, it was human behavior. And human behavior driven by sentiment, how they feel about things, how things look to them. In a larger sense, fear and greed, if you want to call it that. But that drove human behavior. And the more I began to understand that, the more I could react and predict pretty much what markets were going to do. The lesson I learned mostly because we didn't have internet and instant access of news and Twitter and everything else that delivers information so quickly is to understand that first and foremost, when news comes out, it was stale. You read an article in the newspaper, well, that's already out, it's in print, it's there. The markets anticipate things. They don't react to things, really. It's anticipating. And the lesson I learned from that, this is what you and I, a mentor we had back then, he taught me a lesson that when it comes to news, the market makes the news. The news doesn't make the market. Okay, and that was a great lesson to learn back then, because then you would always have an explanation of things. The market was up, you know, a tenth of a percent today. Everybody wanted to know why. Well, gosh, they always had a reason. And I'll tell you, today, here we are 50 years later, it's the same thing. The market took a beating yesterday. It's now 300 points. No one looked at the fact that, my God, we've had a run-up to beat the band over the last 12 months, but look at the market yesterday. Why? Oh, we've got an explanation. Rising interest rates. If you take a look at what's been happening in the bond market, the 10-year, and I read this whole explanation on it, and I said, you know, had the market been up 300 points yesterday, they would have explained that as well. Oh, well, interest rates haven't risen as quickly as possible. They're still optimistic about the Fed. And you and I, that's the cynicism that you and I developed. So Let's get back to that period of time. Didn't have the news feeds. We were really on the pulse of what was going on news-wise. We were in the know. We controlled the information. We were involved in it. And if people weren't, they'd call us up for that. What were they doing? Well, stocks were basically going up, some better than others. You also, as you and I talked about, you had some institutional control and domination in the market because they had much larger assets at stake than the retail segment. 28% of the households involved, most people had pensions. They weren't focused. There was no IRA accounts. It didn't exist. You didn't have a 401k. That didn't exist. Now, people were focused on stocks only for maybe some speculation or part of their money. The kind of money that moved big movements in the stocks was institutionally driven. Yes, some mutual funds, but the pension plans themselves, that people's assets were in, trust portfolios, big institutional moves, and they began to be enthralled with the concept of growth at the time. And you had a real skewing in the market, a very narrow breadth of the market there in that latter move in the 60s, something that became known as the Nifty 50, 50 top growth stocks. And then the terminology used then at the time was one decision investing, that decision being buy. You didn't have to worry about it. You bought these companies, and you hold them, and over time, you're going to make money. Now, we look back at it and laugh at it a little bit now because, oh, my gosh, that's crazy. You know, things change. Industries change. And you can look back and laugh and say, look, they were buying Polaroid. You don't
that's
see
right.
too many Polaroid cameras today.
No more cameras.
You remember Xerox?
Eastman
remember
Kodak.
Xerox?
Yeah, Eastman Xerox, Kodak. Sure. Xerox, absolutely. Big name.
What's that? No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah. But Tony, Ben's a millennial, so he has a different picture.
Yes, so you brought I heard that. The young guys are like, what is that?
So you brought the Nifty 50.
It was technology. But let me bring you a little bit further forward. And now, yeah, that was then. Yeah, we got a little bit wrong. They weren't wrong about what was going on. They had great growth potential, and they were doing quite well. And you could extrapolate that into the future. Sure, these are great companies to own. Why would you ever sell them? Because the theory was you're only going to buy them back at a higher price. Now, anytime you get one-way street thinking, I've learned in my experience, life experience, and handling people's money experiences, the caution flag should be waving. There is no such thing, you know. That great show that used to come on Friday nights, by the way, for your listeners, that was our version of CNBC. On Friday nights, Louis Rukeyser had a program. He'd invite some money managers on, maybe a portfolio analyst or the hottest money manager at the time. They'd have a great discussion on the markets, what's going on. It was great. It was great. Very reserved, quiet time. It wasn't, you know, our friend Kramer standing on a chair and ringing a bell and throwing papers in the air. Very subdued. But if you look back at that time out there and what was going on, there were some people who had that philosophy and were buying the latest and greatest and the best. There weren't tech stocks per se back then, but there were emerging technologies. And there was a guy on there who had beaten, I cannot remember the portfolio manager's name, forgive me. But he had beaten the market, he was doing great, and he painted a great picture of some of these future technologies that were changing the world and would be, and that's where he was focused. And he said that's his system and why he's beating the market. And Lou Rukeyser is a very dry wit. He said, you know, every time I found the key to the stock market, some bastard changed the lock. I never forget that. I never forget that, Tom. I never forget that. Every time I see a quantitative system now, every time I see some algorithmically driven thing and we have figured the market out and we have beaten the market, Louis Rukeyser's words echo in my head. Be careful. Be careful. It just doesn't work like that. I go back to human nature and human behavior. So fast forward a decade forward into the 70s, and then now you've had, well, the Nifty 50 didn't
Wait a minute, Tony. In the 60s, was there a commodity play?
Well, commodities, yes. Again, that's a limited play as far as exposure.
Because
I'm feeling
we're likely to see a commodity play right now with interest rates rising. I mean, for us, for many, many years, we on our charts, interest rates, the interest rate itself had been breaking down, making lower lows. It was clear to us we were going to see lower rates. Now the opposite's happened. We're seeing rates break out. And that mm-hmm. would suggest to me that we may see a commodity play here. How was it back in the 60s?
Well, your driver of interest in commodities, things, hard assets, as we call them, hard assets, whether it was oil, gas, gold, cattle, pork bellies, something of a hard asset, was that as prices rose, as inflation became a factor, those kinds of things would become more dear. They would rise in value. So you had something that was truly a hedge on inflation. So the first time, really, and it wasn't so much the late 60s, and your exposure in commodities, there was just a very small segment of the American population that really had anything to do with commodities, unless you were a farmer or a big farming combine and you were trying to hedge your bets on soybean prices, etc. And they got a couple of splashes there when inflation took off a bit there, and we had different waves of inflation, and that became of interest. And your tie to interest rates is inflation-driven. The Fed uses, you know, money supply to try to control inflation. They try to keep inflation in there, by the way. Their goal is not disinflation. Disinflation is a very bad thing. They try to keep a moderate level of inflation. So, for example, when the economy goes into a big slump, what do? They lower interest rates. They make money more readily available. They put liquidity in the economy, and it's there to be spent, to be borrowed, to leverage, and to expand businesses and grow the economy. And the opposite is true. When things are going very fast, and now labor prices begin to rise, material prices begin to rise, now inflation is a factor. When it exceeds what they're looking for in a target, they'll allow it to exceed. They want to make sure there's still plenty of employment and the economy's going. Then they'll tighten interest rates to, again, begin taking some of that liquidity out of the market. So going back to when commodities really took off, you really have to look at the Arab oil embargo of 1973. Now, I'm a brand new minted advisor. I got my securities license in December of 72. I finished the training program. I come in and I'm all excited. January of 73, the Dow was at an all-time high, 1,036. It would peak somewhere around 1,065. I used to say 1066 because I remember that was the Battle of Hastings and it changed the future of Europe. Well, that changed the future of the stock market for me. That peak in the market, we would not see again until 1982. That's how long it is, 16 years of agony going through that. So when you go back to 1966, February of 66, the Dow hit 1,000. Here we are, January of 73, the Dow's over 1,000. It's just great. And if you go back to 66 to when it really broke that level and pierced it forever, that's 82, that's 16 years. It's a long time. And when you're living it day to day and trying to trade stocks day to day, believe me, it's a long period of time. So my philosophy on it then was, gosh, the markets aren't really going anywhere. Let's try to take advantage of this rolling segments in the market where, you know, this particular group is good, that group is good. So the way you and I and our clients would play commodity, most people didn't want the risk of commodity trading and the margin and the leverage to it. We would buy commodity-driven stocks. So as inflation began to take off then in the 70s, largely driven by increases in fuel prices, which began to trickle through the economy. Oh, it costs more for transportation now, and it costs more for fertilizer, which was obviously driven from natural gas prices. And everything was costing more there. They began to add on to that. So if it costs the farmer X to produce this corn now, well, I've got to get X plus for a bushel. And now the cows are eating the cattle. Beef is going up. The price of beef is going up. The grocery stores increasing their market. And salaries. It was just a spiral of inflation that was in way. And we went crazy over 2% inflation and maybe 3% inflation. That was a big deal.
Now, Tony, what year was that? Because I think in the early 70s, like 1973, 10-year yields were around, you know, 6 to 7%, something like
yes.
that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's where they were. And then so what began to happen was inflation, well, we got to stop this inflation. And politically, it was a battlefront in Congress. And what are we doing about it? And you had, obviously, you had a president there who was fairly into his second year there, 1971, before the second term election for Richard Nixon. It was in his 1971 would have been his third year, right? His third year. And so that's usually a dicey time for presidents anyway. So he decided to put on price controls to try to help stop inflation. The next year, in 1972, he's elected. It's all great out there. Watergate happens in 73, right about the time I'm getting going. Inflation was there, but it wasn't a huge deal. Gerald Ford comes in, and his commitment to stop inflation was a program called WIN, W-I-N,
yeah. WIP Inflation Now.
You remember those buttons, Tommy?
Yeah, I remember WIP the buttons,
inflation,
sure.
Now. Their strategy was through psychology, will get people to stop buying and to cut back buying, reduce demand. In hindsight, it was a pretty dumb thing to do because reduced demand means reduced what? Reduced output, reduced jobs.
Yeah.
you're killing the economy. You're killing the goose that lays the golden egg. But it was another way to do it in a very politically friendly thing. So none of it worked. Inflation began then. With the oil wasn't going back in price. It wasn't a temporary thing. It didn't matter. From now on, everything was going higher. And then inflation in earnest, as the Fed tried, after all these things, the Fed's trying to keep the economy going, still kept interest rates low for quite a bit, flooding more liquidity in the economy. Inflation took off, and then interest rates began to rise, and yet people still kept spending. You didn't matter. You had the prices kept rising anyway. Commodities became very attractive because, my God, you think beef is expensive today. You wait till 6 months from now or a year from now. And because of the leverage, commodities became very attractive. Paintings, collectibles, well, they're going to go up in value because dollars, these paper dollars, they aren't worth as much. Coins. Anyway, we couldn't buy gold. It wasn't legal for American citizens to buy gold until, 81, 82. So we couldn't do that. So we had other ways of investing and benefiting from this inflation. You had to because it wasn't going away. It wasn't until 1981, speaking of 81, when Volcker cranked down hard on interest rates and broke the back of inflation. I mean, obviously, but the economy in the tailspin, but had to do that. And by speaking of interest rates, too, for the young people viewing, you have no idea. Money market funds, money markets, daily liquidity funds were yielding 15% at the peak. A 10-year treasury peaked around a little over 16% yield. Can you imagine that?
Tony,
16%.
I remember buying my father a 16% treasury, and one of my clients, I bought a CD, a 3-year CD, for 13%. But you know what? Back then, when those rates were like those, you could get those kinds of rates. Nobody cared. Gold was going up. You could double your money.
Strangely, you look back on the markets there, and you look at what you could have made potentially in stocks. Because who wanted to buy a stock? Why would I buy a stock? Take all that risk, and you're projecting, oh, maybe this stock will grow at 10% per year. Dude, 10% per year? They're not going to get my attention with that. I can get a risk-free investment here that's going to pay me this for the next 10 years straight. That's hard to resist. In fact, I can recall we were forced to look at other things. We were selling treasury. We were selling municipal bonds, and we were also using zero-coupon treasuries. Do you remember those?
Yes.
So, in other words, you would be able to discount this backwards and come up with an annualized return, but you're only putting up, let's say on the 10-year treasury, $100 on the 1,000, and at maturity, it would mature at that full value. Those were phenomenal. You literally had ways you could show people, had that been able to be replicated in the future, you could make anybody a millionaire with that kind of, you compound money at better than 12% per year. You're going to grow a lot of capital.
And this is back around 1978.
It was the worst of times and the best of times is what I told people. It looked good, but inflation was so high. In fact, we weren't quite like, hyperinflation of some of these countries recently, but we ran somewhere in the 20s, 21, 22% annualized at an inflation rate.
Yeah, think about that. Those people...
That killed everybody.
Millennials today can't even conceive of that, a 20% interest rate, a 20% inflation. Oh, my Lord.
That's how fast it was running. So that's why you say, well, why didn't people just do this or do this? Because you were fearful that, that might be a good return today, Tom Dorsey, but the way your interest rates are going up, I don't know. I'm going to wait. And then what happened? I'm keep harping on human psychology because that was where I really learned my lessons of investing. As interest rates began to decline, did people then say, oh, my gosh, they're coming down now. I need to latch on to that. I need to do this. I need to. No, not at all. The philosophy was, Tony, call me when that 5-year CD gets back over 12%. They're still waiting for that call, okay?
And that tide went out.
Nobody reacted to it.
That tide was going out.
You call me then. Call me then. You call me when those rates come back. And then same with the stock market. The stock market literally bottomed out. We didn't know it. In fact, Tommy, and I will tell this to your listeners here. People ask me about what it was like in the market. Yes, 73, 74 was brutal. It was. It turned your stomach. Everything went down. You couldn't pick a winner, and everything was sour. I don't care how you believed in the future. Even as a young person, I was quite discouraged. And 1975, the market had a nice rally back. After being crushed from peak to trough in 1974, we fell nearly 52%, peak to trough.
Well,
1975 was a huge rally year, as you recall, Tom.
Tony, that rally happened because I came in as a stockbroker then.
I circled that on the chart. Tommy Dorsey's hire date, it was the inflection and the turning point in the stock market.
That's
but what I told you, Tom, yesterday.
The luck of the Irish.
I was 2009.
I'll say this to your listeners.
Same way.
I'm a human being, too. And you turned me around because here's a person coming in who didn't live through that. You had no memory of that. You had no pain from that. So you see the positive. Some of these stocks are moving up, and the prospects look quite good to you. And I'm still stinging from this trough in the decline, and I'm still remembering how painful that was. You had no memory of that, and I began to watch you and listen to you and say, you know what? This young man is right, and this is what you should be doing, and he's the way it should be. And that cycle then, it wasn't just the market rebounding. It was being around someone who saw it through a different lens, through a more positive lens that I used to have. That bear market had changed my religion, so to speak. And then over the years, there's been lots of turns. It's always different, but it's very much the same. The bull markets and the bear markets, in my mind, are driven in the same process. They bull markets end in greed and euphoria, and bear markets end in fear and despair. And that's something that never seems to change.
So, Tony, I mean, you during your career, you've experienced multiple recessions, bull and bear markets. You've seen interest rates north of the 10-year rates above 16%. You've seen 10-year down below 2%.
Yes.
You've had to deal with fear, you've had to deal with greed, you've had to deal with all these emotions. Over this time period, how have you stayed so objective? And what
you know, if you look at what really has kept me positive, and through my career, I've always had that opportunity to travel the entire United States as a national sales director, to be involved with advisors such as yourselves who are dealing with their clients and the public and what's going on. And that sentiment, that firsthand gathering, forget surveys, I would sense it, feel it. I never lost my faith because of that underlying strength of America. We are a can-do nation, and people have a need for positivity. They have needs for products, for services, and these things provide opportunities for people who fill those needs to make profits. And to grow profit for their shareholders and increase dividends. So it's always there. And short-term things, they've always come and gone. And I look at it that way. Another mentor of mine had a great philosophy that he taught me too. Nothing's forever, you know, whether the bad times or the good times. So even it out, take a longer-term view, and you begin to see beyond the dips and valleys, and you'll see that the real direction has been and will continue to be upward for the economy, for the stocks, for profits, for wealth.
But human, you know, let's go to 1982, Tony, where Reagan, you know, had Volcker in as his Fed mm-hmm. chairman, and Volcker decided he's going to start raising rates. 1982, I will never forget. When we look at our bullish percent index, which is our most important long-term market picture, in August of 1982, that took off. If anyone can remember their statistics 101 class in college, the bell curve, it went outside that bell curve. Three standard deviations, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
Yes.
It was so powerful in 1982. Let's talk about that for a second and go forward from 82.
Well, from 82, and that's when I mentioned earlier these peaks in the market February 66, it peaked at 1,000. We really pierced it, but not much in the rally that went through in 1972, going into January of 73, like 1,066. 1982 for your technical analysis was truly a key breakout. And I guess you would call it on a longer-term basis a triple top at 1,000. So you finally pierced it, and it went had great momentum behind it. Now, looking back at what was fueling this, was that you had declining interest rates, sharply declining interest rates, okay? That the interest rates had peaked when they put the foot on the neck of inflation with very high interest rates. So they were coming down, and stocks had looked pretty good. Dividend rates were much, much higher then because they had to compete with stocks, so you had attractive dividend rates. And the tax cuts, the Reagan tax cuts, were beginning to have a positive impact on people's incomes. You know, the tax rates for the is above average, I guess you'd call them, we call them mass affluent market up there, were confiscatory. You had rates up there that were running better than half your money went to the federal government above a certain, 55%, I think, was the top bracket when he took office. And everybody had the philosophy, oh, soak the rich so that the poor can benefit from it at the end of the day. A lot of your discretionary spending came from the people who had something called discretionary income. So it was beginning to have this effect, discretionary income. They had more than they'd had in years, and they're buying stuff, and the economy is beginning to really take off and move, and employment was rising, and then incomes were rising. The auto industry, while still suffering, was adapting and adjusting there in the 80s. Yeah, they had been king and then suddenly devastated. There used to be a saying when I was first getting going, as General Motors went, so went the economy. We were less dependent on the auto industry because we had other industries. You had these new things coming along, chip processing, semiconductors, all these new things that were the newest and greatest technology of the time, and new employment, and then different things were now taking the place and more robust economic growth occurring. All these things were nascent then. They were very small, but they were positive things. So the sentiment of people had changed. Okay, yeah, the recession's behind us. That was, that's 73 market, Tony. That's 10 years ago now. Now you're coming into 1983. There was more optimism, and that sentiment began to change in earnest through that period of the 80s, and it was borne out. And what you had then going forward, you had a good market, not a crazy market, but a good market, with ups and downs and fits and starts, because overall, more money was coming in. You also had the rise of IRAs and people using them in earnest, and 401ks, a new wave of capital coming in. And at the margin, you had foreign investment as well. Today, you still have that. Today, we look at a global market. My son is in the money management business. He travels extensively throughout the world looking at investment opportunities out there. The same is happening over here. You've got trillions of dollars of global capital that's not looking to invest just in their country. They're looking for the best investment opportunities. And fortunately for us, we have a very favorable environment here in the United States now. You've got companies that see the U.S. as a great opportunity, and investors who see the U.S. markets as pretty doggone good. So that's what I keep an eye. I keep an eye on people. I don't know much about the technicals of things. I don't know much about, what's the right valuation for stocks and all these wonderful models people create, but I understand sentiment. And at the end of the day, human sentiment drives demand for goods and services. Human sentiment drives demand for stocks.
Tony, let's fast forward to 1987. You talk about human sentiment. 1987, another period that we lived through. Millennials mm-hmm. cannot remember. Total devastation. Run up to that. Run up through the 80s, and let's go to 87.
What I liked about what was interesting, I'll put it that interesting about that decline in late 87, October of 87, was its speed with which it all occurred there. Some tightening going on with the Fed. The economy had done well. Well, they got to fine-tune it a little bit here. So you had a scenario where the market had done quite well for a couple of years. Nothing like the current, but it had done quite well. And suddenly, the specter of rising interest rates and that competition for money out there became negative. And then suddenly, as you go back, and it's easy to do, go look at the archives of the papers out there. Now they're worried about a recession coming the next year in 88. You hadn't heard that word in a while. You could have a recession in 1988. You've had a great run here, but now, you guys, it's time to pull in your horns on the market. So the market began to get soft. It was weakening. Then the headlines then were all focused on this. What are the negatives? Why is it going on with the market? And this negative sentiment began to build on itself. And then because of what was then something new and exciting, these trading programs by institutional investors, they had trigger points that were automated, built into them. This is long before the safety switches that the SEC, in fact, one of the reasons why the SEC put these in place out there was to prevent this kind of violent moves in the market. But we didn't have those. We didn't have those safety things then. You had portfolio insurance was a new concept. They were using puts. They were, you know, writing calls. They had different ways of trying to insulate their investors from these moves in the market, but not any exchange controls. So when the market began to crack up, we had several bad days in a row there in October, the week leading to what we then called the crash that occurred the following Monday. But you had very weak days. My goodness, this is bad. This is really a sharp decline. For the technical analysis of it, it had broken support. It had fallen through all of these moving averages. This was a sharp decline, and this is it's not going to come back easy. So you knew that. So all these trigger points, the people with the automated program, big, dominant, large institutional who were all subscribing to this, that hit their trigger points with no safety nets there in the marketplace. And then on Monday, you had an absolute collapse. We fell nearly 22% in a day. Now, that's a classic bear market, usually taking place over a two-year average lifetime.
Right.
It's a 20% decline. So we had a bear market in a day that was already down, you know, prior going into it. And in hindsight, of course, that would become one of the greatest buy points for many, many stocks in a lifetime. You wouldn't see it again. Why? There was no demand to speak of, and yet massive amounts of supply being triggered as every one of these breaker points was hit. If it falls below this, sell. Fall below that, sell. And this automated process there, you know, this better, you know who was laughing, God rest his soul, was probably Lou Rukeyser, because the people who thought they found a key to locking in profit.
Somebody changed the lock.
they got their head handed to them.
Yeah.
And there was nothing to stop it. So a free fall. The prices were ridiculous when you look back on it.
Well, Tony,
you look back on it now, it's ridiculous. But
for me, Tony,
that's changed.
Dorsey Wright was just 10 months old. I had to,
oh my God!
I had to turn the company 180 around to survive. You know, we were an option strategy company to begin with, and options were going to get the blame for that. So I said, you know, we're no longer an option company. We're now a technical analysis company.
Yeah. They were looking for blame. They were looking for
right.
blame. Those bad guys on Wall Street out there. But at the end of the day, the reasons, you know, for the market being soft or declined, yeah, that was all fairly valid. But that kind of price movement is never rational. And when you see that, it usually means opportunity, you know, buy or sell. The next year, by the way, 1988, was not a good year. Volume fell dramatically on the market. The interest in stocks fell dramatically. It was a great year to accumulate, but it wasn't bull. You really didn't get a resumption of that bull market till going into the 90s. And your best bellwether of knowing what was going on there is to look at the rise of mutual fund assets. When you look at the long-term chart on total assets in mutual funds, and what was happening then, baby boomers were all getting into their 50s. That's their accumulation years out there. They're all working. They've all got 401ks now, the IRA accounts. That rise, mutual funds were a great vehicle to use in that, you know, diversified portfolio, professional management, et cetera. And those assets began to rise. And you talk about when you turn the market around. I was hired by Federated in February of 1990, and I circle that on the chart because the inflection up in mutual fund assets was like a hockey stick over the next decade, right straight up. we went from basically $280 billion to over $6 trillion in assets. It's a massive increase in wealth. And a lot of those were stock funds, bonds, and so that money was all coming in. So that was a heck of a bit of kerosene for a great bull market there that I took a bow for, you know, so yes, this was.
And falling interest rates, right, Tony? I mean, the 90s were
terrified
by that.
Exactly. And what really happened, and that they didn't fall in a straight line. You had bond markets that were up and down. There was bond markets going back up. The yields are going right straight back up again. All these things, when you segment them in time, you can say, why wouldn't people have wanted to buy those 8% treasuries there or whatever? And no, you know, because they actually were rising. The rates were rising. They're not going to buy them. And then it was lower highs and lower lows and lower highs and lower lows. And no one, and I would tell you that, and I know people who trade billions in fixed income, no one saw them going as low as they ultimately would because no one knew the financial crisis was coming, and they sure didn't know how to react to that when the Fed then, in emergency liquidity in the market, literally let interest rates go to zero, trying to keep that collapse from happening. And that, to me, again, another tremendous buy signal on stocks because nobody wanted stocks. Oh, my God, companies are going bankrupt. You don't know what's going to happen to the banking industry. The news was horrendous. There was a real reason why there was fear and why people wanted out of the market. In hindsight, you look back at it and say, oh, my God, what a tremendous buying opportunity. So you just want to be always attuned to that overall sentiment at extremes, the very good, the euphoria that I talked about, and the despair at the other side of it. Because at the end of the day, human beings need products. We need services. You know, we need stuff. That doesn't change. How it's delivered, the products change, the services change, the companies, you know, some win, some lose out there. But human need is the same. And investing, there's a need for investment as well. There's a need to make money. There's a need to grow your wealth. How are you going to do that?
Well, Tony, let's go back and encapsulate. What if I said 1960s, give me a few words or a couple of words that would encapsulate the 1960s, then we'll go to the 70s, 80s, and then we'll look at where we are now.
1960s, I would encapsulate as a time of positivity, of an economy that continued to build upon the household building, marriages, children coming along for the baby boomers, population growth, job growth, and a market that kind of trailed right along with that at the core.
And types of investments.
Basic investments, you know, blue chip industrial America. Auto stocks, banking stocks, the petroleum stocks, core stuff was great. At the latter part of that bull market and new technologies arising, and you'll remember a name, optical scanning.
Optical scanning.
You don't think about
yeah.
stuff like that. You go to the grocery store and they scan these things over there. That was brilliant new technology that was going to bring great productivity and inventory control and all this great stuff. We'd never had anything. It was amazing. The stock was trading at several hundreds of times of earnings, even future earnings out there, and you want to know. So then people were looking for other stocks and new technologies like that. So we didn't have the tech bubble in the dot-com, but you had a focus on growth and technology in the late 60s.
And then optical scanning is still there. Anyone goes to a supermarket and they scan your goods. That's what was so new to us back then.
Tommy, I will tell you, the technology, they were right. These things are great, but it doesn't mean you're going to make money in the investment. That's what
right.
the lesson to be learned awesome. From that. Then, of course, that busted. And then, the stock valuations busted. And the Nifty 50 collapse there that basically went under in 73, 74, devastating for portfolios, especially institutions who had bought that philosophy.
So, Tony, in the Nifty 50, people would buy the stocks with the Nifty 50, those 50 stocks that were all-timers, figuring, okay, so what? If I don't buy the stock right and it goes against me, just hold on because their earnings are going to continue to increase and they will expand into themselves.
You'll eventually win because these are the best and the brightest managements, the best companies, et cetera. Yeah, I mean, that was the philosophy of it out there. Yeah, had there been ETFs back then, there would have been an ETF created for the Nifty 50. You know, this Absolutely. Is what all you need to do, buy this. It beat the market. They were beating the market. The market overall, really, it was a two-tiered market. In the 70s, that early 70s, I should say, I got to differentiate. The early 70s, just before that market peak out there, those great industrial companies, the manufacturing company, the housing stocks, the appliance makers, all those stocks did very poorly. They did okay. You really weren't making any money, maybe collecting dividend returns. The real game began in the technology and the growth stocks and these Nifty 50, so they were beating the market dramatically. So, yes, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy. Moving forward then, what happened after that? Well, you didn't go wrong with a lot of the oil and gas and energy stocks.
That's in the 70s,
there.
Yeah.
Yeah, you made good money in them,
Tony,
into the 80s.
Tony, do you remember Houston Oil and Minerals?
Of course I do. Occidental Petroleum. There was a lot. City Service. Yeah, all these companies. We knew every oil company by because you had. What was the saying from one of our mentors? Yeah, if you want to make a pile, you got to be in style. You had to follow those trends. So they were, and the trends would come and go, and that was great. So overall, now you and I have the benefit of hindsight. You and I have the benefit of tremendous reams of data. You can look back on it now and say, you know what? You really didn't need to do much of anything. Had you simply bought the S&P 500 index and ridden through all of the ups and downs of it out there, you did amazingly well. You know, this was great. And in fact, this is an interesting point to remind people. If you had the S&P 500, even at the bottom of the market crash, it bottomed in March of 2009, actually. People talk about 2008, it was devastating. The bottom didn't occur till March of 2009. If you just held on to it, you never sold anything, you kept your index, you didn't lose any money. See, again, this is hindsight. You look and say, no, you didn't lose any money. It went down, but look where it is today. The fact of the matter is we live day to day. The news is day to day, and you watch it. So push back a little bit. Remember these long-term lessons. Remember this longer-term perspective. And I think your listeners, as you and I do, we keep a very positive bent on things. We're realistic. We understand volatility. It's always been there. It's always going to be there. We understand the fact that nothing's forever. That this might be a great concept today. Recently, I've been trying to learn more about blockchain and about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies because there's a great deal of interest in them. And I'll tell you what my takeaway from it is. Blockchain is a very interesting new way of storing value and storing information because of its concept. It's like a worldwide network of computers that you can create ledger entries into. It's a bookkeeping system, basically, that could keep the record of your value. That's long overdue, and I think that truly will revolutionize. I think the banking industry, I think financial industry, many companies can benefit from blockchain, you know, from putting this data information out there. Now, whether Bitcoin is the currency of the future or some other cryptocurrency, I don't know, and I can't understand its value right now. But see, that's something there. It's a concept. But Tony, how does an investor make money? Be careful.
Tony, last year I was at a cocktail party with Jack Bogle, and I went up to Jack and I said, Jack, I said, you know, the older I get, the more I get just like you. And he said, what do you mean? And he said, what do you mean, Tom? I said, I like to drive a straight line.
Yeah.
And that's where smart indexing and things like that, instead of jumping back and forth into what's in style. If you want to make a pile, get in what's in style. Oh, Lord. You know, that's like going up 95 North and deciding, okay, the traffic's getting a little heavy here. I think I'll get off on this tributary. I'll go on rural route 76 and I'll get on rural route 152. I'll beat that little logjam there, and it never happens.
Yeah. So, Tony, I mean, you've had a few kind of Tony-isms today. You wrote a book, right, and published a book in 2005 called The Grass is Always Greener When You Water It. Is that right?
Yes, indeed. Yes, I wrote the book, and my book was written primarily for my own of advisors, and I was reminding them of some of these longer term views. And as you, I'm sure you've read it and you loved it, of course. But
absolutely,
in there,
you sent me a copy.
I, the key thing I talk about, what am I talking about? I'm talking about people and understanding their needs and where you fit in to provide value for them. And I think it applies to so many different things in life, actually, and that need for positivity. Nothing happens with a negative viewpoint. Yes, near term, you might be right. Like you're saying, Tom, you're caught in a jam on 95. I'm going to go over to 17. I'm going to go around this. I'm going to do it like that. You think you're moving forward out there. Yeah. But at the end of the day, sometimes you just weather it out and you go forward. You're going to end up in the same place without a lot of hassle
exactly.
of getting there. And that's my philosophy was in the book. And people griping, and I heard this from a salesman, and you have heard this. Anybody hears us all the time. When so-and-so is doing rather well, oh, well, that guy, he's got better territory, you know.
Yeah.
The manager likes him better.
He's got family money.
They come from money, and, you know, they're family money, and they've had a bigger advantage over the average guy. There are these different things that happen. Some people will have those things. But at the end of the day, my philosophy was, you're not going to change it. What are you going to do about it? You've got your own patch of farmland here. You've got your own grass. How are you going to make it greener? And you can. And that's the philosophy of the book. Thanks for the plug.
Yeah, you're welcome. You can find it on Amazon. If you just type in your name or search for it.
Well, yes.
Some good phrases.
Tommy, anybody wants that book, you let me know. I'll help them out.
A bird in the hand can show you two in the bush. I like that one.
Tony, Tony, you just retired from the National Sales Manager at Federated.
I did.
But, I mean – you know, I was talking to you the other day, and I said, you know what? You retired, but you got a lot more to go. I mean, anyone listening to this better be thinking about how they might grab you for some consulting or you know, I talked about the Wild Hogs, get all of us old guys together like that movie, The Wild Hogs. We got a lot left in us. You know, we can do more stuff. And, you know, that's why I wanted to get you on. You know, most people didn't live through the 60s and 70s. And we may be in a type of market that may resemble something like that, but it always helps to get a clear picture of what went on back then. Because if you understand the history of things, then you'll be much better picture of where we are now. So where we are now, right now, would you be positive? Am I not correct?
Of course, that's my nature. People are always going to see some positive there because I'm looking beyond the hills and the valleys. You know, I keep a positive nature of it. Now, as you pointed out, are we over? Yes, we're overbought. There's been people are missing it. They want to jump in on the game here and do this. But I still keep a close eye on and an ear open for signs of euphoria. This, you know, there's no losing in this sort of a thing. The other thing is I would tell people is do listen to someone who's been around a while. Take some umbrage here. You know, be a little humble. Just listen to someone else who's been around. When the market collapsed in the financial industry, took a beating there because of the nonsense that was going on with the subprime loans out there. And Merrill Lynch didn't go bankrupt, but they were shotgun wedding into Bank of America. And that was the greatest financial firm of all time. It was just a fabulous company, great success, et cetera. How could this happen? And they interviewed Wynn Smith, who was a distant relative of
Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner, and Smith. Yep.
Pierce, Fenner, and Smith. He was a distant relative of that descendant up there. But he was on a rise to become a CEO, and they thought, of course, they thought he was disgruntled, and he left the firm. But they said, what went wrong? And it was an interesting analysis. And I took to it, Tom, because of my philosophy about people. He said they lost. They wanted to bring in the biggest and the brightest, and their strategy, the strategy that was employed, obviously, was new regime. We got to have new thinkers, and we want the new MBA people and the new finance people coming in. And the old guys were all one by one pushed out of the company. That was Stanley O'Neill's philosophy. You want the biggest, the brightest, the best right now. No old thinking, new thing. He says, and that's fine, he said, but you lost your memory. You lost your memory. Everything we've been talking about, these booms, these busts, the Wall Street scandals and scams and all these things, that's memory. That's important to know.
That's
and when
why
you've got
I
everybody, if we think of this, if you hired every single employee tomorrow, right now, fresh, what is their perspective? It's very limited. It's
That's
very
right.
short.
Exactly. Very limited.
You're doomed to repeat a lot of the mistakes of the past.
That's exactly right. Well, you know, Tony, we're probably going to run a little long here, but I just want to mention one thing. Do you remember A.B. Jones?
Of course.
A.B. Jones, one of the great all-time brokers back in the day. He was a country boy. And I remember after my first year, you know, when I came in, options had just debuted, and I became an option guy. And
yes,
after that first year, jumping around circles and doing all kinds of crazy things with options, and I can't say making people money, A.B. Jones took me aside. He said, Tom, he said, let me tell you something. He said, ain't but one way to make money in the stock market. And I said, how's that, A.B.? He said, slowly. And he turned around and walked off. And I've never forgotten that moment in my life, and he was exactly right. He was one of the old-timers. A.B., at that point in time, probably went back 20 years, you know, prior to where we were in the 70s. So there's so much to be learned from people who've been around a long time, and there's not many of us left now, Tone. That's why I wanted to grab you and get you on this tape. We're going to have to go ahead and cut this off.
Okay.
I don't want to go too long. I mean, we could have sat here and talked all day about
that's it. For another day, Tom.
But you're one of the only people that I know that can go blow-by-blow description of exactly what happened between 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, where we are today. And I really appreciate that, Tony. And don't forget the wild hogs. We got a lot left in us, man. You may have retired, but you know what? You're going to get sick of golfing, and you're going to want to get right back in this business. I know it.
Oh, I still keep an eye on things, Tom, but thank you so much. Thanks for having me. I'm delighted, and I hope everybody enjoyed some of my reminiscing of the past.
Yeah, we need it. Tony, thank you very much, buddy.
Okay, guys. You have a great day. Thank you.